Well, if your home is in need of fixing, or maybe you're planning to do some remodeling, or maybe you have some mold issues, who knows? There are all kinds of things that can happen to a house. Just ask me. Almost everything that could happen has happened to my place. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking home renovation, repair, and inspection issues with our two guests, regular guys who come by pretty often here on the Ideas Net to talk with you. Ken Adams of Adams Design and Construction in Madison specializes in residential renovation projects. Ken, nice to have you back.
Good to be here. Nice to see you.
And John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg, involved with historic restoration, water issues, and also a licensed home inspector. And John, thank you so much for coming by as well.
Great to be back, Larry.
You guys are busy.
Oh, yes.
Very.
this is really you pretty much stay busy all year, I assume.
Well, we sort of drag our feet in the wintertime, try to slow it down because it's hard to get up and go outside when it's cold. But right now, it's pretty insane. There's a lot of work going on, and it's a lot of people calling, asking to get things done that they would have been putting off for a while.
Yeah, I would guess. And probably the best time to have called and asked about that was a month or two back, at least.
And we had a little bit of breathing room. But it's wonderful. It's still, it's the weather's great. Everybody seems to be in a good mood, and it's a good time for construction and remodeling in the Madison area and Wisconsin in general.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dick in Springfield's online already with a question, so let's go to Dick. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Hi. This is really repair issued more than designing anything new. But,
okay. No
it's
problem.
It's a vibration in the heating, air conditioning ductwork. I run my fan 24 hours a day because of the orientation of the house and uneven temperatures. And over the last year, this vibration has begun, and it is more frequent, although not on all the time, and it's getting louder and louder to the point it wakes you up at night. And I've been able to localize it between the first and second floor in the master bathroom, but the closest horizontal entry duct's probably 5 or 8 feet away. And I'm wondering if there's some way to deal with this without ripping out the ceiling underneath it or the floor above it. I did talk to the guy that most recently switched out our furnace and air conditioner a couple of years ago, and he took a pass on it. He said, those are tough problems.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Well, John, I'll start with you. What do you think?
Well, we've got two possibilities. Either we have a vibration that's caused by something mechanical, or we've got a vibration that's caused by airflow. The mechanical is pretty easy to check. Check the bearings in your fan and see if you've got vibration dampers between your air handler and your ducts. If you don't have them, they're pretty easy to put in. Some furnaces, such as Lennox Pulses, that have a burner that vibrate, require that they be put in when the new furnace is put in. And basically all it is you take a little bit of the solid metal ductwork out and you have basically, it's a cloth that fits in between that does not transfer vibration from the furnace into the ductwork.
Right.
So that would be an easy thing to do and an easy thing to check.
If that solves the problem.
If that solves the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Now, is your furnace a variable speed fan or is it a single speed?
No, it's variable speed.
It's variable speed. And are you getting this vibration at all speeds?
I must admit, I don't know.
Okay, that's something else to check with. If you are getting no vibration at low volume, it could be that we've got some sort of harmonics. This is not my specialty, but we have something going on inside a duct that maybe when the pressure increases, we're getting some sort of movement of air inside the duct that's rattling the duct remote from the furnace. But why don't you try the obvious things first? Is just check the bearings in your fan. You should be able to feel right at the furnace whether you've got vibration just by putting your hand on it. If that is the case, I'm sure your HVAC guy could put in some vibration dampers for you.
I can walk around in the bathroom and cause this to stop when it's happening.
Oh, really?
Which makes me think it's quite localized.
Yeah.
So that may indeed be airflow then.
And there's no way to get to the duct from the it's in a finished space between the first and second floor or through
right.
the floor.
Yeah.
One thing you can try to do is take the register off in the bathroom and the room surrounding it and see if that has an effect on it. That's going to lower the back pressure in the duct, and if that helps, then that gives you a clue that perhaps we need to keep the fan running at a lower speed or we need to have a little bit more net open area on the grills and registers. But since you've got that variable speed fan, do a little bit of testing, sort of chart when you hear it and when you don't. Mm. And if it is due to air movement, maybe we can either restrict the air movement or we can make it easier for the air to move out of that particular duct.
Gotcha. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
Good problem.
And Stephen in Genoa City, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Well, I've got a water problem in the basement, and I bought a house basically on a marsh area. It was built with a full basement, and basically about maybe two or three feet below the water line. And they essentially tried to solve the problem. I guess they had a lot of water problems, obviously. Mm-hmm. And they poured another slab over the original slab, trying to seal everything. And they also had a 12-inch wall, concrete wall, up to the water table to prevent, obviously, the back pressure or the water pressure. And they put in two sump pumps, but obviously no drainage tile. They did put drainage tile around the house above the water table. I actually discovered that as I dug around the foundation. And I'm not sure where it drains to, but that's my problem. I'm not sure exactly what to do.
Does the water seep in, or is
oh, yeah.
it
yeah,
just
I've
constant
got,
seepage?
Oh, yeah. Or
okay.
I've got little rivers flowing through my basement floor.
Well, they made a big mistake by putting a slab down without putting more drain tile in.
Right.
So
well, see, and that's the thing. I mean, I'm located probably about 50 feet from the marsh, so I do get a lot of water. Now, again, would you suggest, I've seen two possible ways of dealing with this, is actually drill through the foundation and put in little plugs with hose barbs and then just drain that into the sumps. Or I've seen cutting around the perimeter on the slab and putting in drain tile.
Well, let's start with what you would do in a new situation. First of all, you would put drain tile around the perimeter of the foundation at the footing level or just outside of the footing. You would also have weep holes through the footing and another drain tile inside.
Right.
All this drain tile would be connected, and it would go to your sump pumps.
Yeah.
And then your sump pumps would the sump would fill and the pumps would pump it out to a desirable location.
Mm-hmm.
Now it sounds to me like their first mistake was that they put in drain tile on the perimeter outside, but it's higher than the water table. So no matter what it's not going to function. So ideally, if you could dig down around the perimeter of because you've got a lot of water there, if you could dig down to that level. Expose the footings and put a drain tile around the outside.
Mm-hmm.
See if there's a place to put, if they put weep holes through the footings.
Mm-hmm.
If so, great, you can tie into them. And if not, you'd probably need a good excavator to decide whether or not that's feasible to do.
Mm-hmm.
It complicates the matters inside because you've got that extra, you say, a foot of flooring?
Amazing because I was having water. It was actually like a geyser, so I drilled through, to try to relieve some of that pressure, and I was shocked because I found another slab below the slab I was dealing with, and they tried
mercy.
To seal it with silicone, where the cracks were.
Yeah, that's all kind of an amateurish solution, somebody that didn't know what they were doing.
Sure.
No offense. I hope he's not a friend of yours who did the work. But
I bought this house as is, and I was quite aware of the fact that there was going to be water in the basement. And normally in the area they don't even put basements, and nowadays they wouldn't even be allowed to put in a basement under those circumstances.
But what you want to still keep a functioning basement, and if you do you want to do that, you may end up having to take out your basement floor or at least cut out the perimeter. There's a technique, I know Larry's done it to his house, it's a great success, and they dig out about a 2-foot section on the inside of the foundation, and they put drain tile in there, send all that to the sump.
Right.
And if you've got, you're basically sitting in the water, so you need to that water's going to be moving continuously.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean it's not, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is that a workable solution? I mean, I don't want to, cut through the concrete and put in, perimeter drain if that won't work.
Well, generally speaking, it is. I've built several houses in with high water tables in areas where there were underground rivers and such, and we've done that thing very successfully. Well, we've had drain tile, like I said before, drain tile outside, drain tile inside, tied together into a sump and pump it out into the neighbor's front lawn. No, I'm kidding about the neighbor's front lawn. But fine, that's another thing. You want to find a good place to put the water so you're not, creating problems with your neighbors.
Or you could do
I am running it right now and back into the marsh.
Yeah, so it's a big cycle.
As far away from the house as possible.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, the other choice is probably what one of my neighbors did, which was to raise his house up.
Well, that's true. Yeah, you could.
He raised his whole house up several feet, and then
built a higher floor in the basement.
Built a higher floor in the basement.
Yeah.
To get above the water, and that's an expensive little proposition.
Yeah, I think unless you're really sitting low on your property, that's probably, let's put that as plan B.
Yeah, well, I said, I mean, I would love that, but my foundation is already sticking about 4 feet off the ground because they realized, obviously, and I don't know basically what their thinking was even in building in that area, but they realized that they couldn't go down too far.
How old is the place?
It was built in 1949.
Okay, so that's so, they just probably weren't aware of some of the problems that they were going to run into over time.
Right.
So, well, good luck to you, Stephen.
Yeah, good luck.
Report back when you get it fixed.
Yeah, report back when you get it fixed. These guys will be on in another couple months and you come back and let... However, if it doesn't work, work or no, let us know. Thanks for calling. Deb in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Deb.
Hi. My problem today is it's more seasonal. In the wintertime, I have a problem with the smoke from the chimneys when they're burning wood smoke in the neighborhood. It comes into my house. And I think it's getting sucked in through the air-to-air heat exchange, and then it goes through my electrostatic air cleaner, but I smell smoke.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how to solve that problem or who I should even talk to about it.
Boy, that's a tough one, John.
That's becoming a code issue in a lot of areas. A lot of areas now are restricting the use of wood-burning stoves.
Mm-hmm.
You see it all over the West and the valleys of Colorado because we're developing wood smoke smog.
Yes, I'm on the side of the hill also, but I'm not sure how to approach this problem.
Well, it's very difficult because you've got a heat recovery vent system, which is exactly what you want, but it is not going to clean smoke out for you. Generally, what we try to do is we try to pressurize the house, but to pressurize the house, we need to draw in air through the heat recovery vent system, and that's the source of your problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit intractable, and I guess what we've seen in New England and in the West is we've seen limitations and even bans on wood burning.
Well, you might be able to do something like look around the house, see if there's a place that you could relocate the intake without too much work. That might be a cleaner space. Some people have had some luck with activated charcoal filters because that will take some of the smoke out of the air as it comes in, but then you're adding another layer, and that might add more restrictions to your system and cause a problem for the motors and your... The motor in your heat recovery vent system.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
Air-to-air heat exchanger is the term that I grew up with. So
should I have that system checked out, I guess, by a heating contractor?
Well, not just any heating contractor. You want to make sure that they've got some experience in this. John, you know a lot more about this than I do. Why don't you talk about this?
They do have the transfer medium could be changed out. You may find that it is a bit dirty and sooty at this point. Some of them are actually made of cellulose. It depends on whether you've got a Life Breath or a Mitsubishi or whatever. So it's probably worth looking at that. I think that Ken has a good idea on possibly relocating the intake port. You're probably getting wind from one particular direction, and it's probably very hard for you to go outside and determine where the clean air is. But maybe you can, and if so, you could simply relocate the intake part. And I would have it serviced because if it is drawing in a lot of smoke, it probably is losing its efficiency as well. Mm-hmm. How many years has the heat recovery vent system been in, Deb?
Oh, I think about 7.
Yeah, probably a good time to have it checked in any case.
Mm-hmm.
And you're probably going to have to talk to your local code authorities, your alderman or your county rep, as the price for natural gas and fuel oil rises, and it's certainly going to be rising again this winter. We're going to see more and more wood burning in northern Wisconsin, and we're developing a pollution problem.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Those are your choices, Deb. Thank you.
Thank you.
And good luck. Appreciate your call. You can join in as well. If you have a question, we'll go on to John and Wilson next, but there's an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking home renovation, repair, and inspection issues with Ken Adams of Adams Design and Construction in Madison, John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg. Glad to have you listening in. And lots of people online now, so let's go back to the phone. And John in Wilson, you are next. Hi, John.
Hello. Yes, we own a small ranch-style home with a basement. And the basement isn't really insulated. The only insulation, I believe, is insulation that was poured in the concrete blocks that form the basement walls. And I'm wondering what would be the best way to insulate those walls. I'm assuming that it is a good idea to insulate them.
Is cement block walls?
It's concrete block.
You're right. Okay, concrete block. Well, I'll tell you, the best way to insulate them is if you were to dig down around the outside and put insulation on the outside of the perimeter of the foundation. It's difficult and very expensive, so a lot of people choose not to do that. If you decide that you want to insulate the inside, the trouble with concrete block is that it's very porous and it allows moisture through it, and you're creating a much colder wall by insulating the inside. So I would say the best solution is to put in at least a couple inches of insulation on the outside of the foundation.
So would you go all the way down to the base of the wall, or would you just go down so many feet from the surface?
Well, the best thing is to go down to the base of the wall. But if you can't, at least go down to the frost line or just slightly below the frost line, and that will help a great deal.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah,
you know, another thing you can do while you're doing that is you could seal the cement block on the outside to keep any potential future leaking problems from occurring or stave them off anyway.
Yeah, I think that was done when the house was built. It's about 35 or 40 years old.
Well, they tended not to do that good a job back then.
Well, they often use an asphalt product too, John, and you'll probably find that asphalt product is pretty well gone. But if you dig down, put on a peel-and-stick membrane, that's going to get you a lot of bang for the buck. And the other nice thing about this exterior foam insulation is it's also going to relieve a little bit of frost pressure against the wall. Hmm. It'll compress before it pops the seams in your blocks and shoves your wall in, because older concrete block foundations aren't real good against lateral pressure.
Okay.
What type of foam insulation would you recommend then? Just styrofoam or urethane or...
Yeah, the pink stuff by Formular, it's an extruded polystyrene.
Okay.
Polyurethane, rather. Dow makes a product like that. There's several different ones out there. And there's some new green products out there that are based on expanded polystyrene, I think it is, that are coming into their own. And that's a little more of an environmentally friendly way to look at it. So do a little research online and... talk to a couple of insulators if you've got anybody that specializes in green building. It might be somebody that you can talk to and just get some more knowledge in your arsenal before you do it.
And remember, John, that you're going to have to put a protective coating on this, because otherwise the sunlight and the weed whacker are going to damage it.
Bugs too,
and mice. So you're probably going to want to put on a brush-on cementous coating. So when you do choose a product, make sure that it's something that's going to be compatible with a coating that you can apply yourself.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Otherwise, it peels right off the wall.
That's right. We've seen that happen. People have used the wrong stuff, and you see the cement falling off.
I certainly have seen that. I've had a lot of experience with all these things. Thanks, John. John and Ettrick, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Yeah, I've got my house was built in 1951, and it's with a 2x4 stud wall. And I'm going to re-side my house probably this summer. And the problem being, it's a really cold, leaky house, so a lot of traffic noise I can hear inside. And just wondering what's the best way to do when I do a tear off, as far as using like a 3/4 or 1 inch foam insulation or whatever.
Well, what do you have on the building now, Jen?
Well, right on the building now, I bought the house the way it is. It's aluminum siding, and then it's got the original siding yet.
Okay. So you tear off the aluminum, tear off the original siding, and go from there? Is that what you're planning?
I believe I'm going to tear right down to the board.
That's the best way to do it. Yeah. Well, what I would do is I would put on a minimum of 1 inch of insulation on the exterior sheathing.
Okay.
There's a couple things you want to consider after you do that. Is you want to make sure that you're not creating cold spots around the window frames. Do you have sash weighted windows? You know, the old fashioned cords.
I do. But the cords have been removed, and I got replaced windows in there.
Okay. Then you may want to pull the casing off the exterior and see if it's insulated, at least on one of them. Or a better bet is before you even start the process, get one of your local energy auditors in there and have them do a blower door test on the house and walk around with an infrared camera, and they'll give you a great report on where your house's strengths and weaknesses are with regard to the its heat loss. And then you've got that in your you've got that information in your hand. You can approach this more intelligently. They'll be able to tell you whether or not those window cavities have been insulated, and if they haven't, you could probably pull the casing off the exterior casing and put new insulation in there, and then replace the casing with new. Then you don't have a cold spot there. So then you've got your 1 inch foam around the entire perimeter. If you do that, a good thing to do would be something called a rain screen system over the top of that. And that's what that does is it separates the siding from the house by a small amount and allows moisture and air to move behind the siding a little bit.
Okay. You said it's wrap? You said like a house wrap?
Well, if you put an exterior sheathing on, probably you could either get away with Tyvek or one of those types of products, or you can get away, or you can use... what would you say, one layer 15-pound felt or two layers of 15-pound felt?
It depends upon the type of siding. What sort of siding are you going to be putting on, John?
That's a good point.
I'm going to use that new Louisiana Pacific. It's like a fiber.
Oh, smart siding?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I don't have any experience with smart siding, but I remember reading up on it recently, and you probably want to do something like felt underneath it and separate it would be nice with a rain screen
system. It would
system.
Be, yeah. There's been so many failures with the fibrous type sidings, Louisiana Pacific, Georgia Pacific, Interseal siding, all of that stuff in the past. I'm not sure, Ken, do you know of a single one that has succeeded in the past? Because I think they've all failed.
No, they've succeeded until the contractor got paid. You know?
But the reason
that's true. They have a very high failure rate. Go ahead and tell them.
Yeah, and the reason Ken is suggesting a rain screen system with a little airspace in back, John, is then that siding is going to dry from both sides. So if you're using a wood siding or a fiber siding, anything that has a fiber in it that can absorb water, it's nice to be able to allow it to dry both ways.
Okay.
All right.
That'd be good. Thank you.
Yeah, good luck to you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Sharon in Green Bay, hi to you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband and I own a quad-level house that was built in 1977 with electric heat, and we supplement it with a wood stove. But we are contemplating getting central air conditioning, and I know because we don't have any ductwork, we have to have a special type of unit, something that I know sits outside and sits up. Stairs in the attic and has little holes that are drilled into the walls. But, you know, we're just kind of at phase one, and we don't know, you know, what we should look for a contractor or brand names or if there's some internet websites we could do a little research before we go out and start, you know, getting estimates.
Sure, Sharon. There are at least three manufacturers of what are called high-velocity systems. Now, a high-velocity system has a powerful fan, and you're moving the air at higher pressure and higher speed, so you use much smaller ducts.
Okay.
And Unico is one. If you simply go into the web and type in high velocity air conditioning, you're going to go to several different sites. The other thing you may want to think about, Mitsubishi and several other companies make air conditioners that you can put in each room. And what it is it's a small cooling coil and an air handler, and you place one in each room. You can operate them separately, and then they go back to a single outside condensing unit. The nice thing about them is if you only want the master bedroom cooled at night, you just turn that one on. If you're out in the living room and only want that, you turn that one on. It's a totally different type of system because it's ductless. And you have a complicated house with four levels. And it could be that running line sets is going to be a lot easier than running ducts. So why don't you take a look at that sort of system as well?
Okay.
And with the contractors, you get references. That's
somebody
always
with experience in both.
Yes.
Both of those types of systems would be really helpful.
Find out what experience they have. Get the names of a couple people where they have put them in. And the room by room ones, such as the Mitsubishi, are really pretty foolproof. The duct ones can really be quite complicated, and I'm afraid I don't know anybody in Green Bay who's good at it. We do have a couple people who specialize here in Madison, and we've helped design some of the systems, and make them work in a four-level house can be quite difficult.
Well, I mean, the fourth level is the basement, and of course, we wouldn't need that, anything done with that. So I guess we're talking three levels, but still, we understand that, it's going to be, a little more pricey than your conventional system because of the ducts. But as I said, we're just at the starting point, and we know that we should get rolling pretty soon because summer is going to be upon us sooner than we think.
Yeah. Well, at least if you do look at the high-velocity system, is you can work out ways of heating the house with that as well in case the electric heat does become too expensive. So that's one upside versus the room-by-room type like the Mitsubishis. So take a look at all of those options. Check with your local utility and see what you're paying per BTU for electricity versus natural gas, and correct it by the efficiency factor. And that may help you make your decision as well.
All right. Thanks for all your information.
Thanks for calling, Sharon.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. And let's take another call. Jack in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just bought a 100-year-old house, so I have a couple quick questions. The first one concerns the basement. It's old concrete, and it's dry, but it's pockmarked from rock, like stones in the concrete being dislodged. And I was wondering if I could just coat it with something to make it even. I don't want to make a rec room, but I would like a decent work area. And then the other question is, I have the pull chains on my lights, and can they be converted to wall units, wall switches?
Yes. Let's deal with the concrete first. Typically, 100-year-old concrete is often still good, but the surface looks pretty bad. It's lost a little bit of the calcium or Portland bonder in it. You can indeed coat it. You will probably find that some of the coating will fall off, but that's okay. But use a silicate-based coating. Don't use a paint-type coating.
Not concrete.
I'm sorry?
Not a layer of concrete?
That would be an awful lot of work. I suppose you could try to trowel something over it, but most things I'm thinking of are Portland cement, and they are going to fall off because your concrete is really quite porous, and so you're going to have some vapor pressure. Take a look at a product called ThoroSeal. It's ThoroSeal, which is a powder that you can mix up either into a paste or a paint or even like a putty, so you can fill some of the deeper holes with it. And then brush it over. It's a silicate based. Almost any brickyard in Milwaukee is going to carry it. Now, on the electrical, the one thing you want to find out on your electrical, if it's 100 years old, you very likely have knob and tube wiring, and you're going to want to think about replacing that over the next decade, because at some point you're probably going to have problems getting insurance for the house. Knob and tube wiring cannot be insulated over in any manner because it's a heat dissipating wiring. And the insurance companies are getting more and more leery about insuring houses with it, except they don't really know how to handle it, because if you ask the average person, do you have knob and tube wiring, they really don't know. So you really need to have a good electrician come and do a survey of your house. Those old pull chain lights, most certainly you can indeed put wall switches in. It requires a little cutting. But have a complete plan for electrical renovation of the house if it's needed, so you get rid of the knob and tube, you get rid of any potential fire hazards, and you improve the convenience of the house.
I'd put that on the critical path, too. That should be one of the first things you do on the house, because anytime you want to insulate or anything, it's going to hold you up if you have to rethink your electrical as you go.
That's very true. And if you have knob and tube on the second floor light fixtures and a lot of insulation in your attic, you have an active fire hazard, and you want to get that taken care of.
Good luck. Thanks, Jack, for calling. Appreciate it. And Mike in Eagle River, you're next. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. How are you, gentlemen, this morning?
Great.
Very good. Thanks.
Approximately 4 years ago, we built a house, and there is a 24 by 24 garage that was put next to the house. Approximately 6 months after we moved in, I noticed just a small crack about 6 feet from the corner. Well, over the last 2 years, the crack has progressed to the back corner of the garage. Now, I had someone come out and take a look at it, and it's approximately dropped 2 inches between the flat part of the garage and where it's, you know, it's gone down.
Right.
Okay. They tell me that there was a possibility that they overdug the foundation when they put the house in. What is the best way to fix this? Would I be better off to just tear the slab out and have somebody come in and redo it? What are your thoughts about mud jacking? What can you help me with here?
Is the garage on a foundation or is it just a slab garage?
It's just a slab garage.
So if you were going to replace the slab, you got to take the whole garage apart and then do
pretty
the slab.
Much. Yeah, pretty much.
Well, John's shaking his head no. I'm shaking my head yes with mud jacking. I've had some good luck in the past with mud jacking large
you
driveways.
Have, okay.
I have never tried it with a garage when you've got a heavy load on it. So you'd probably need a special guy, somebody that really knows his stuff, to let you know if that's going to work. Ideally, the best thing is to take it down and do it over.
Okay.
Probably what happened is they didn't compact the sand underneath when they built it. I see this a lot in new construction. They just throw the sand back in and then pour over the top of it. And over time, the sand compacts and the concrete's just sitting out there in limbo, basically.
Yeah, because he did a level from like the middle to the left and the middle to the right, and the middle to the side that isn't down is like it's settled an eighth of an inch.
Yeah, and that's not unusual, but 2 inches is a lot.
Yeah.
Mud jacking, when they say mud, but what it is, it's a mixture of sand and what is it? It's sand and something else in water is basically it. So it's once it's pumped in there, it stays pretty dense, and it does. And I, like I say, I've had some really good luck with it on driveways that have had pretty heavy equipment driven over it afterwards. I don't have any experience with a garage. It might be worth a try. Have you talked to any mud jackers?
No, I have not. I have not done that yet.
Why don't you get a price and see what it costs, what the cost benefit is for each process, and then make a decision.
Okay.
All right, thanks for
calling. All right, thank you very much.
Good
appreciate
luck to you.
It. Karen in Hortonville, hello to you.
Hello. We are undertaking a master bathroom remodel, and the best place to put the shower is on the only wall with a window currently in it. We have arranged to put a small window in another wall so that we can put the shower there, but I'm hating to give up that eastern exposure, and I'm wondering if there's any way to put in a glass block window that will remain not a problem for me.
Not a problem in the sense that it's going to leak?
Right, or moisture getting into the wall. Or
Well, we do glass block shower walls quite frequently with great luck, with great success. And so if you've got somebody that knows how to install a glass block wall in place, and tie it in with your interior tile, or are you going to use a different type of surface inside, like Corian or that sort of thing?
I was planning to use a tile.
Okay, that would be perfect. And then the only other problem you want to make sure of is that it's flashed properly outside. We do tend to like to size the windows so they sit up a little higher for two reasons. One is it doesn't get direct splash from water. And the second one is it gives you a little more privacy. People see more silhouette of your your head rather than your entire body. It's just a little more of a privacy issue. That's because I'm in the city. But we've had great luck with that. And I also recommend, if you're doing a master bath, spend a lot of time away from the house because it's really stressful to remodel.
Well, we actually have moved to the other side of the house, other bathroom, so it won't be quite so stressful and we can close it off.
There you go.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Karen. Good luck. Appreciate the call. And Scott in Oconomowoc, I believe, is next. So let's go to Scott. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I'm enjoying the show.
Thank you.
My question is, we have a gas forced air furnace, and I am evaluating replacing it. And I know as you go up in the efficiency rating of the furnace, that the price doesn't necessarily move up lockstep, but it goes up quite a bit. And I'm wondering what your recommendation is, and where do you get to the point of diminishing returns on increasing the efficiency of a forced air furnace?
You're probably looking at getting 92% efficiency for $2,000 to $2,400, depending upon the time of year and the rebates available. I don't think you're going to get anything much better than 96%. Do you know anything better than 96 at this point, Ken?
I don't. I know that what some people do, and we've been doing adding an air conditioner that's got a heat pump in it so that they can reverse it different times of the year, and that helps in moderate temperatures. To heat the house, and that helps increase some efficiency. Well, not necessarily increase efficiency, but it uses electrical heat that's a little bit cheaper at this point. So,
yeah, I think that what you're probably going to find, you're going from 92 to 96%. I mean, 4 percentage points is not going to have a huge savings in your gas bill. Take last year's heat bill. If it was $2,000, you're looking at saving $80. Take that over 20 years of the furnace, and is it worth, you're going to save $1,600, is it worth spending $4,000 instead of $2,400? I don't know. Part of it depends on how long you're going to be there, the warranty on the furnace.
Sometimes efficiency, though, is more than just that. It's the same reason people buy a Prius. It's not necessarily to save money because it can cost you more to buy it, but it's also as a political and a social statement, too. So.
The other thing to think about, Scott, is air conditioning. I don't know whether your house is air conditioned or not, but I guess what I would probably look at is buying the 92% efficient furnace, but then try to get a SEER 14 or 16 air conditioner where you're really going to have some big savings and lower the carbon footprint a little bit.
So, we are contemplating that, and obviously it makes sense to do that work because our air conditioning unit is about the same age as the furnace, so we could probably do them all at the same time. And I was even contemplating, because I have kids that have asthma and allergies, an electrostatic filter of some sort, and wondered what your thoughts were on how well those work.
Oh, well, I can tell you, I'm an asthmatic, and I use HEPA filters. I use freestanding units, and I keep one down in the first level of my house and one in the second level, and it's been a great, great help to me. I understand with electrostatic precipitators that they tend to lose their efficiency over time, although I don't have any data to back that up. You might want to check into that. But I know that HEPA filters, and they usually, the better ones use two pre-filters. They work well. They'll take large viruses out of the room. You know, they'll take smoke. They'll take, 0.5 microns. They'll clean a space to 0.5 microns if you've...
I thought there's some that go to 0.3 now.
Maybe that could be, and that's small. Man,
that's small.
So if
we've tried that, but my wife complains that they're noisy.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. You know, in the past, I did a clean room about 15 years ago that they ran HEPA filters, and they designed a system with their heating contractor that put the HEPA filters in line in the system. And although it was a little bit of a pricey setup, it was very quiet because the motor was down at the furnace level rather than a freestanding unit in your living area. So that might be something that you can look at too. So electrostatic precipitators, they may be a pretty good bet. Like I say, I think they do lose efficiency over time, but I know HEPA's are definitely worth looking into.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Marlene in Slinger, it's your turn. Hi, Marlene.
Good morning. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for your program.
You
really
bet.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
My question today is in regard to roofing. I'm going to have to re-roof my 1960 house. I need to know, are ridge vents any good? Is non-tab roofing good? And they say they've got some copper that goes into roofing that will eliminate mold. I'd like those three questions answered.
Ridge vents are great. There's a lot of different types of ridge vents, though. The old metal ones that pinged in the rain and let snow blow in aren't very good. GAF Cobra vent is pretty good. There's a company called CoreVent that has a very nice website, CoreVent.com, CoreVent.com. They are extremely consumer-friendly. They'll give you cross-sectional drawings. They'll tell you how to calculate the ventilation you need for your house. You'll be able to do all the engineering yourself by going to that particular website.
Would you repeat that, please?
CoreVent.com, CoreVent.com.
Okay.
Very, very consumer friendly and helpful.
Where is it purchasable?
Right through them.
Oh, it is direct sales.
Yes, they do direct sales. They started in the business specializing in vents for historic houses that were very hard to vent. Mm-hmm. And you'll see lots of information that have nothing to do with a 1960 house. But if you had a 1920 bungalow with open eaves, you would think it was great. but they will give you a wonderful education. On roofing, I don't care whether it's tab-free, jet, architectural grade. You want to look at two things. One is the warranty. You're not going to buy anything with less than a 30-year warranty. And then the other thing to look at is look at the wind rating. A 60-mile-an-hour wind rating isn't much of a wind rating. And you will find roofs in the 80s. In fact, I just put on a roof. I believe the wind rating is 118 miles an hour. So you really want to get some longevity out of the roof. There are some other things out there. Some companies now give a labor and materials warranty for the life of the roof. You have to pay a little extra for it. But it's only available through certified installers. I know GAF has that program, and you could probably talk to GAF about a certified installer in your area. And I suspect some of the other manufacturers do as well. The use of copper or zinc in the roofs would help, not necessarily with mold, but with lichen and some sorts of fungi. Is your house real shaded, Marlene, that you've had a lot of?
I realize I could take all the trees down.
No, we don't want to do that.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Yes, I do have a problem, but it isn't terrible.
Yeah.
But it's there, and if I can do something to eliminate it, it would be better.
That would be a good time to do it, I guess.
I'm more familiar with using the old-fashioned zinc ridges from Klauer, K-L-A-U-E-R, has those available. If you go online, there are several companies that have copper ridges as well, and you could put a zinc or copper ridge on top of a CoreVent, which we're doing on a historic house in Belleville right now to protect his wood shingles.
So good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ken Adams and John Freiberger are our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your home, renovation, repair, inspection, all those kinds of things, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Steve in Madison is next, so let's go to Steve. Hi, thank you for calling.
Morning. I have a question about new construction in a townhouse condominium. So we have three levels. The furnace is on the first floor. It's just a slab on grade. And there's evidently a blocked duct on the third level and going into the bedroom. The heating contractor did a balance report, and they hardly got any kind of a reading out of one of these. They tried to bring in a fellow with a video camera, but he could only get in about 6 feet, and he couldn't make the first right-angle turn because the cable was so stiff. I wonder if you have any idea of anybody in Madison who might have a more flexible kind of camera setup that they could actually do about, well, probably 30 or 40 feet to get all the way down to the furnace.
Well, the only thing that comes to my mind are there are some plumbing contractors who do sewer work, and they have very flexible cameras. So you may want to call around to some company that does plumbing and heating. I don't know of anybody offhand. Maybe Pertzborn might. I'm not sure. Do you have any names on the top of your head?
Well, I've used people in the past, but you never know whether they're still in business. But
yeah.
I know some of the sewer cleaners.
Yeah, sewer cleaners
have those cameras because they want to see whether the pipe has collapsed or that sort of thing. So, I think plumbing contractors, sewer contractors, I would expect the chimney sweeps equipment is all far too stiff because they're usually doing just straight shots and short angles.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll find someone out there with just a couple of phone calls, or maybe someone will hear this and call in the show and let us know.
But I guess the question there would be running a cable through my heating duct that's been in somebody's sewer. I don't know how clean they...
they're clean. They clean them up.
They have to clean them every time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yep. All right, thanks.
Thanks for calling. Joe and Hayward, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. I just got an estimate to replace my forced air furnace. I had an old Sears one, and I got an estimate for 80% efficiency, $2,284, and $85 extra for a digital thermostat that would allow me to just run the fan in the summer and bring up some of the cold air from the basement, and then $200 extra for a 10-year parts and labor warranty. And I wondered what your thoughts were on that kind of a arrangement, whether I might consider a 90% efficiency. But I was just thinking that's a condensing furnace, isn't it, that requires extra arrangement to get rid of the water and put it into a floor drain. And I thought the 80% efficient one would be less troublesome, with less maintenance problems maybe.
Hmm. One of the questions is, what is the 80% measuring? Is that the fuel utilization efficiency, or is that the seasonal efficiency? Because the two of them are different. You can have a furnace that has an 80% AFUE efficiency that's only 65% seasonally efficient. Because if it is not bringing in its own outside air, Joe, whatever it's sending up the chimney is going to be coming in through your walls and windows, and you're going to have to heat. So if the 80% is annual fuel utilization, the actual seasonal efficiency is lower than that. So there may be a bigger gulf between this furnace and a condensing furnace than you're thinking of.
I see.
Getting rid of the water from a condensing furnace doesn't have to be a big problem. You can go out to almost any hardware store or your local farm and fleet, and you can get what's called a condensate pump, which is a little sump pump the size of a shoebox. You put it on the floor next to the furnace. You put a plastic tube on it. You can run it across the ceiling to a laundry tub or some other place so you don't have this hose running across the floor to a floor drain.
No, the heating contractor will do that for me.
Right, heating contractor will do it, or if money's an issue, you can certainly do it yourself. But do a little bit more checking. Take a look at your annual heating bills. What if you save 10% a year, and if you're going to multiply that by, let's say, 10 years, is that a good investment? You may find that moving up to 90 or 92% efficiency is going to be good, and I think you're not going to be spending many more dollars to get there. I would guess you're probably going to only spend about $200
more. Well, I asked about it, and it was more than $200, and there was a caveat about if you don't drain the water in the winter, because this is for a summer residents, and if you don't drain it right in the winter, it'll freeze and all kinds of problems result then.
Okay, so you're only heating it part of the year.
Yeah, usually.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, that makes a big difference. Mm-hmm.
So maybe the 80%er isn't a bad idea then.
Right, if you're basically just heating in the spring and the fall, then your energy usage isn't going to be that great.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Andy and Ettrick, it's your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good.
Got a question. I've got a house built in 1923, gutted out a sun porch that was unheated. I ran heat duct to it. I'm wondering, I insulated the ceiling. I want to put the car siding on. Do I need to vapor barrier the whole thing with plastic? I guess I'm going to car side the ceiling and put the log siding on the outside of the sunroom. But because the way the 2x4 is rough sawn oak, it's you know, wavy. I was thinking I might have to glue it in some area and shim it up, but that's not going to work with if I vapor bury it with the plastic. What is that something that has to be done with vapor barrier? Or?
Well, what kind of insulation you have up there?
I'm just gonna. I had the old blown in, but I tore that all off. You know, it was all the plaster last. Completely gutted that. So now I have laying insulation in there, and I guess I have the plastic on it, you know, now as a vapor barrier, but I'm just wondering, I put it right, you know, stapled it right to the rafters. Should I have...
No, that's appropriate. You probably should leave that on there because when you're going to use this boxcar siding, my experience is that it's very hard to get that to become its own vapor barrier. It's just there's too many, you know, knot holes. The tongue doesn't fit the groove tightly in some spots, and you're going to have moisture working its way up through there, and you don't want that.
And we're going to take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with John Freiberger and Ken Adams. Stay with us. We will be right back. Lots of great questions today about home renovation, repair, and inspection things. Larry Mueller here with Ken Adams of Adams Design and Construction in Madison and John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates of Fitchburg. Glad to have them here and for you to be listening in. And we'll go right back to the phones and to Cindy in Plainfield, who is next. Cindy, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
We are going to be replacing a roof on a three-bedroom ranch home built in 89, and we're thinking about replacing it with a metal roof. What can you tell me about metal roofing for homes?
Getting more popular.
They are. You're seeing more and more of them around. There's several different levels of quality. There's the quote, barn roof that are made out of aluminum, and... they're not that good. They're not flashed that well. There's a type that's you don't solder them together, but they stand together and you crimp them down.
Right, it's a standing seam.
Standing seam roof.
Yeah, and there's actually 8 different varieties of those.
Oh, you talk about it then.
I'm just
going to sit here and relax.
We get a lot of questions on metal roofs, and if you go to your local library and take out a copy of architectural graphic standards, they've got pages and pages on the different types of metal roofs that we use in architecture today. The quality of the coatings on a lot of the metal roofs have greatly improved in the last decade, so that they have these new factory introduced coatings that seem to have extremely long lives. We were seeing roofs lose their color after 10 to 15 years, 20 years ago, but they certainly are much better. When you get into things like the copper roofs, you're looking at an awful lot of money because of the cost of materials. So you're probably looking at aluminum or a steel standing seam roof. Mm-hmm. Make sure that the contractor has done quite a few of them in the past. There are a few contractors out there that actually have their own forming systems, where they basically drive up with roll stock and a semi, and they measure it, and they make everything on site. Other contractors have to order everything pre-cut, and if your house is an inch out of square or something, you can have all kinds of different problems. So be sure that the contractors had a lot of experience. Don't talk your local guy into shingle guy into experimenting on you.
Okay, the roofs that we're looking at are not the standing seam metal roofs. They're an aluminum roof, and they're made to look like the shingles or the shakes. And the way I understand it, they're in bales similar to an asphalt shingle.
Oh.
Yes. Okay. So this is the tab type small sectional roofing.
Right.
Yeah.
The way I understand it.
Right. Same situation there. The coatings and things have gotten to be much better than they were in the past. They've got really quite a wide variety of styles that are available as well. We have specified them for some historic houses because you want a particular look. And those much, much easier to put on.
So could a local contractor put on those types of metal roofs?
Yes, I think he certainly can. What you want to make sure that you have is every contractor is going to have on their website or available from the factory installation instructions in great detail.
Okay.
And you want to make sure you have a full set of that, that you have a set, and that the contractor has a set, and that your contract with the contractor refers to installation as per those standards. And make sure that he reads them before he signs the contract.
Okay. Right. Okay. How are these roofs to withstand hail damage?
They can be damaged by hail. We are actually replacing a fairly heavy gauge steel one this summer that was hail damaged. So they will be damaged by hail, but the size of hail that is going to damage them is also going to damage all but the very, very heaviest asphalt roof.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you get up to the 40 and 50 year or the lifetime asphalt roof, you do have some good hail resistance there, and you have good hail resistance on wooden roofs, which is not something you're going to put on a ranch house. So I think it's the luck of the draw. Your insurance company, if it's going to have to replace this, would be replacing any other type of roof as well, I think.
Now, I heard you talking to another woman about the wind resistance. How are these metal roofs for the wind resistance?
You're going to have to check with the manufacturer, but I think you're going to find with the heavier gauge roofs that it's going to be excellent. You're probably going to be up in the 120-mile-an-hour range, and the nailing is probably going to be more important than any bending factor in the shingle pieces themselves.
Okay.
There's another issue I want to bring up, and you were talking about these being aluminum. I've seen in the past roofers work with unlike metals, and what you've got, you're going to have some flashings probably where a wall and a roof meet, or valley flashings and that sort of thing. Make sure that they don't put galvanized metal up against this aluminum, because then you have two metals that are with different levels of nobility, shall we say, and they actually create a battery, and you destroy one of the metals in the process. Another thing I've seen is aluminum flashing nailed with galvanized nails. You've got to make sure that they use all the proper equipment and have no unlike metals touching each other.
Okay. These will be all the things that will be in the manufacturer's installation and structure.
They have to be followed.
Right, and you may want to go through with a yellow highlighter. And if you didn't know it, assume that your contractor didn't know it either and discuss it with him.
Okay. Now, when it rains, is this going to sound tinny, or are they insulated, like with some kind of a rubber backing or something? Or
nope.
It's going to be noisier.
It'll be noisier. Okay.
Yeah. And you know, some people like that in all but the heaviest rains. You know, it could be nice in a light rain, but it depends on what you're looking for.
Cindy, the other thing to think about is heat buildup, and all the finishes are going to have a reflection index, and you should be able to get information about how much heat it builds up. I certainly wouldn't want to be putting a dark brown or a black or a dark gray roof on a ranch house with this. It could get so hot it would actually melt the tar off the felt underneath. So you're probably going to be looking at a lighter color.
Okay.
And don't they also, quite often put furring strips down, sleepers, to keep the metal roof off the deck, and that allows for heat to dissipate between the two?
That is correct. Yeah. When you get
I don't
to
know
the,
if you could do that with these type of shingle,
well,
though.
Well, you can, but it's much more difficult. It's much more frequently done with a standing seam roof.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okie dokie. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling, Cindy. And Jim in Bailey's Harbor, it is your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm looking at putting some new siding on our home. We put an addition on, and then I removed all the old siding and the old Celotex, the old insulation, re-insulated, resheeted, and have paper covering it. And I want to put cedar siding on. And I'm wondering if you would recommend sealing the back before I put the new siding on, and if so, what would you recommend using?
Absolutely seal it. You'll really be happy down the road if you did. And
okay.
How are you going to finish the front?
Probably a stain.
Well, you could use the same material on the back.
Okay.
Do a single coat. And another thing to be considerate of is the butt joints. Whenever you butt two pieces together, it's good to seal those ends.
The ends, okay.
And also have, are you going to do the work yourself?
I hope to.
Okay, then also behind the Behind every joint, we usually put a flashing. It could be just a piece of felt, an extra piece of felt, to make sure moisture doesn't get in between the cracks, between the seams, and get on and behind the layer below.
Okay. And then when I put the addition on, I did that first, and then did the rest of the siding of, off the old part of the house after the first part was done. And some of that house wrap now is a little weathered, because I haven't been as quick about it as I thought I might be. Mm-hmm. Would you recommend going over that, removing it, and redoing it, or can I just go over the top?
Is it felt or is it Tyvek?
It's Tyvek, and then I used another brand also. I think I have a mixture of two different kinds.
I believe that the manufacturers actually have a limit for sun exposure on them.
Right, they'd say.
And I think the safe thing, Jim, is just to simply go right over what you have there again.
So I don't have to remove it, though.
Yeah.
No.
I don't think you do.
Yeah,
I'm surprised, Ken, you didn't mention rain screen here.
Oh, well, I already mentioned it. Go ahead, John.
Oh.
It's your turn.
I don't know whether you caught our earlier discussion.
He's in Bailey's Harbor, and he's close to some big body of water.
Yeah, you're near a lake. You're in an area that's pretty damp, and if you can go to a rain screen system where you apply the cedar siding out over little furring strips, you are going to extend the life of that cedar siding just immensely.
Oh, okay. So actual furring strips. Then.
Right. Now, I think that Forest Products Lab has actually got a publication now on how to do that as well.
They may. Okay. There's also, if you go online and look up the Journal of Light Construction, they've got an article. You can do a search of previous articles, and they've got a wonderful, maybe 3 or 4 page article on rain screen systems with nice images, good, like I say, good graphics, well written.
Great.
It's a great resource.
Yeah, that's right. Jim, one other quick thing to think about is that with certain stains and pre-finishers, you can get a 15 to 20 year warranty on the finish as well. And rather than you pre-finishing all of the siding before you put it up, have it priced by your local lumber yard with a pre-finish.
Sure.
Oh, pre-finished cedar.
Yeah, because what they do is they will actually pressure finish it, and you can pressure finish it 1 or 2 coats.
And you'll add a lot of life to the...
Tremendous amount of life to it. I know Cabot's, I think, has a pretty good program, and we certainly use a lot of Cabot's products, but there's other great products out there as well. But it does cost a bit of money, especially for a two-coat system. But the thing is, you're going to have uniformity, you're going to have a real good coat, and you're not going to spend all summer in the backyard trying to get lumber to dry. And
you can enjoy a sunrise.
Stacking and restacking things on your sawhorses.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, good advice.
All right, thanks, Jim. Thanks a lot for calling. And Martin in Wausau, you are up. Hi, Martin.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We are interested in buying a new home, and it's an older home, I think about 100 years old, and it has a boiler, not a furnace. We've never had a boiler before, and we're concerned because it's run by oil. They've got a couple of oil tanks in the basement, and there's kind of a smell down there in the room to the oil tanks, or near the oil tanks. And they also hooked up a wood-burning stove, so it can actually be heated by the wood or the oil. Mm-hmm. Interested in converting it over to natural gas. There's also a natural gas line into the basement. Wondered about your thoughts on that, or also possibly converting it to some kind of biodiesel if that would be feasible. So do you have any thoughts on that?
Almost all boilers can be converted from oil to natural gas. Basically, you're looking at switching out the burners because the casing and things are really the same. You simply need a mechanical contractor who still knows something about boilers, and I think most of those guys are my age now. So
maybe with a little white hair,
2 years younger than Santa Claus.
Too. Yeah. But it is done all the time, and that will then allow you to get rid of those oil tanks, and you'll be able to clean up the oil smell. Certainly, hydrocarbon fumes in a basement can really lead to some nasty allergic reactions. So it sounds like a good way to go.
Okay, right. So you would recommend doing that, and then the loss. They're talking about the BTUs are less in a different kind of fuel. That shouldn't be a concern to us.
Well, that's where you need a competent person to size it correctly. They're going to take a look at the size of the boiler. It's probably a cast iron core. They'll count the core sections and measure them. They'll figure the BTUs you need. They'll figure the BTU requirement for the house. Now, you've got an old house, and depending upon how old that boiler is, the boiler may well be oversized currently, too. You know, if people have added insulation in the attic, fixed the windows a bit. So have your heating contractor come in and look at it as if he was going to put a new boiler in it. And then it may make sense to resize this one. We go into so many houses, and some of them literally have twice the BTUs that they really need to heat the house.
Okay. And then the last question on that is the guy that's selling the house, he was talking to us about how a boiler is a good way to go versus a furnace because there's no moving parts, it's not going to break down, that kind of thing. Is there, do you have any other thoughts on that? If we're going to end up putting some money into changing this over, would there be any reason to rethink the whole boiler versus something, a furnace in the first place?
Yeah. A lot of factors come into that question, Martin, and of course the big one is air conditioning. But you're up in Wausau, so you're not going to need it that frequently. The type of house, how easy it is to run ducts, it becomes a very complicated equation.
Okay. Very good. Thanks so much.
Yep. Thanks for calling, Mart. Barbie in the town of Ahrens. It's your turn now. Hi, Barbie.
Hi, guys. I can really relate to the previous caller since we own a house that's dated back to 1848 log home, and we just converted over to natural gas from an oil boiler. So it's wonderful to get that tank out of the basement.
What are you going to do with all that extra room?
Yeah. Ooh, well, we found plenty of uses for it anyway. More stuff. Anyway, we added on to our home recently, and we've got a kind of a peculiar sort of a, I'll say it's like sewer gas smell coming out of the drain where the washing machine drains into. We moved the washing machine from the basement up into the second floor, and there's this funny smell coming out of there. And I've talked to a friend of mine, and he says, oh, they put in a studer vent. They shouldn't have done that. So I'm calling to find out what that is and maybe how this can be fixed.
Well, a properly installed studer vent should not cause any sewer gases to escape. They're basically a one-way valve that just allows air to flow in to help the drain work. So, if you're getting smell in there, did they put a trap underneath the drain? Do you know if there's a little
U-shaped? Yeah, it's one of those ones that's in the wall.
Yeah. Who was your? Do you know who your contractor was? Can you talk to him about this?
That's coming out in about a week.
Okay. Well, that would be the question that I would ask first, because unless your studer vent is stuck open, it could be stuck in the open position if they did that.
Right.
If they put one of those in, but typically you wouldn't get any smell in the house unless you didn't have a trap at the somewhere down in the line so that water sort of basically
right.
they
right.
use water to basically seal the line.
Okay.
Yeah. Good luck. That's kind of an inconvenience, huh?
Yeah, kind of.
Thanks, Barbie.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Bye bye. Tom in Escanaba, Michigan. Hello to you.
Good. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
I'm working on my camp, and I'm going with PEX to redo the water lines. I was wondering, how good is that stuff?
Boy, everybody that I knew, every plumber I know is using it more and more often. I don't know how it is. In this camp, are you shutting the water down in the wintertime?
Yeah.
I don't know how well you have to drain the system to, how it holds up over in cold weather, so you there's probably data on it from the manufacturer to let you know what you can run into. But the stuff's great; it's easy to work with. It's very flexible. It's it's kind of really speeds up the plumbing process, the rough-in process. So from that perspective, it's really good. From like I say, the issue that I'd be concerned about is freezing. And making sure that you can drain the system properly. So I would check with the manufacturer, check with maybe a couple of plumbers that you know or that you in your local area, and see if they've had any experience with that, and go from there. You want anything to add, John? Nope.
No. Okay.
I said it all.
Thanks for calling. And on to Joe in Cottage Grove. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I had a friend of mine is looking to put a new roof on. It's a flat roof, and one of the contractors they talked to had mentioned it's called bitumen roofing material, and I just wanted to kind of get your guys' idea of what your thoughts are on that type of material. Is it good, or is it something that's been tested?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been out there for a good 100 years. There's all different types. There's torch down. There's glue down. It is a roofing. I think generally it's more expensive than an elastomeric membrane at this point. So I think he's going to want to get bids on several different types. The great thing about the EPDM membrane is basically what you've got is an automobile tire. So if you got a problem with it, you can put a patch on it just like you used to patch an inner tube. If you've got a seam problem with a bitumen roof, because there's a lot more seams with it, it can be a little bit difficult to find it and to secure the leak.
Now, is there this typical roof? There's not it's all over his business, and there's not going to be a lot of foot traffic up there. They don't have any rooftop units or anything like that. Would this be probably a good choice considering the situation compared to other options price wise and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you? Think it's a good which option, the bitumen or the other you were talking about was what's it called?
The EPDM elastomeric membrane.
I'll bet you the EPDM roof is what we sort of commonly refer to as a rubber roof.
Right.
There's 60 mil rubber, which is a pretty thick rubber roof. It's a pretty darn good roof, and it might be. My guess is that it's going to be about 15% cheaper, maybe not quite that much, but 10-15% cheaper. That may be an issue. My experience is that I've had a lot less problems over the years with rubber roofs than I have with bitumen or bitumen or however you want to. You say tomato, I say tomato.
No, I think you're right, Ken. When you do have any kind of asphalt product, I really want to see some pitch on that roof.
Yeah.
But you'll get membrane roofs with water ponding on them, and they perform just fine.
Well, they could also slope the roof with insulation board, too, underneath either one of the roofs.
That's so right. You can use iso-insulation, but we're adding costs there. Joe, I guess I'd suggest your friend get quotes on a couple different roofing systems from a couple different roofers and then take a look at the warranties.
Mm-hmm. And go from there. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Somebody emailed in and wondered, you mentioned you weren't happy with fiber siding to an extent. Does that extend to fiber cement siding?
No.
No, it does not. No,
that's a good thing.
We really encourage the use of fiber cement siding. And I don't want to besmirch the current reputation of GP or LP or anybody else. It's just that we do so much work.
Fixing things
and lawsuits over the old things. And
part of it is installation, too. Some of these wood products, if they're installed properly, they should last. I mean, what basically has to happen is they have to be allowed to dry off.
That's right.
And, an inexpensive wood fiber siding can last a long, long time if it dries properly in between rainstorms. Most of the time, they're just not installed well. So good luck. Definitely fiber cement's a good way to go. And enjoy this beautiful, beautiful weather we're having.
And I'm glad to hear that fiber cement siding is good.
We're putting it on your
Ken Adams of Adams Design and Construction in Madison specializes in residential renovation. John Freiberger of Freiberger Associates in Fitchburg, involved with historic restoration, water issues, and is also a licensed home inspector. Thanks to those guys. They'll be back soon. We'll do it again with them. And thank you for listening. Coming up Friday on Garden Talk, Molly Murray comes by from the UW-Madison Arboretum. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.